As we enjoy this first day of spring, the spring equinox, this week it's all about underwater archaeology, the search for Atlantis with a return visit from Daryl Miklos of Cooper's Treasure, a Discovery Channel special that featured the work of former astronaut Gordon Cooper and the maps he made of the great seas of our planet. We're going to take a closer look at what Daryl discovered back in 2018 and what he presented to us a couple of years ago and some of the evidence for artificiality and buildings in the Caribbean Sea. Later, we'll hear from a Zuni elder who will describe the pandemic according to prophecy. All this and the news with Bruce Fenton on Earth Ancients. For Saturday, March 20th, 2021, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how are you? Happy Saturday. Yeah, it's Saturday. This is being recorded here in Northern California. And I'm Cliff Dunning, your host. So I hope you're doing well. Hey, also, it is the spring equinox. It starts today, so that means hopefully weather is getting better. You can get out and more and hike and get into the fresh air. Hey, I got my vaccine, my Pfizer Part 1 vaccine on Tuesday. And Kaiser is my carrier, so I waited in a huge, it was a conference hall, huge conference hall. And they are able to do 3,000 people a day. They're not doing that many yet. They haven't ramped up yet because they haven't got the distribution. But I was lucky enough to get them. Strangely enough, I got a lot of flack from the anti-vaxxers who were not happy that I got my shot. But I have to travel. I have to go to different countries every year. And, you know, they're probably going to make it mandatory with all these variants that you have to have proof of a vaccination of some kind. And, I mean, a lot of people are going to resist it, and I understand your feelings about it, but I'm fine. I've had a lot of other friends and associates getting the vaccine around the world. I've heard from different people in different parts of UK. And even Latin America is starting to ramp up their vaccine program. So I have to get it because I have to travel. As you know, I'll be in Egypt in May and then Mexico in October. And Mexico's dealing with their own pandemic right now. And it's a bit out of control because they just don't have the infrastructure to monitor it. And there's different states that are having spikes. And so anyhow, it wasn't a big deal. I got it. And I'll get part two in a few weeks. And then I get on a plane in May. I just have to follow the guidance that I'm getting on this on these vaccines and get my shot. So hey, this week we are focusing on underwater archaeology, and this is something I've wanted to cover for a number of months. Now, we're going to have Daryl Miklos on the program to give us an update. It's a short update on what he's been up to, and he really represents a new breed of divers who are searching for anomalies and have found them. He has found in the Caribbean Ocean, Caribbean Ocean, he's found evidence of a small city and what I call an observatory. And we will hear exactly what he calls it. Now, A number of reporting agencies, including the UK Daily, Time Magazine, and others, are calling this phenomenon, this one object underwater, 300 feet underwater, by the way, they're calling it a UFO. And he gets a little incensed. Daryl gets incensed about that because he never said once that this was a UFO or suspected UFO. In fact, they call it an underwater anomaly. And we're going to hear a little more detail about that today because he's had a chance to kind of consider it. But this kind of underwater discovery, underwater research, is really in its infancy. I mean, as a kid, I used to watch Jacques Cousteau do dives off different areas of the world, and he was really ahead of himself by decades. But following Jacques Cousteau, there really hasn't been a great deal of research, and it's very expensive. You have to have qualified divers, and there's not a lot of work that's being done. Now, in our own sector, people like Graham Hancock, Dr. Robert Schock, and others have made their own dives. Graham Hancock dove off the coast of India and was looking at the remains of Dwarka. And Dwarka is considered Krishna's city, Lord Krishna. And it's ancient. I think they dated it to over 12,000 years or older based on the artifacts that they have removed. But Robert Schock has dived in Japan underwater, the Yunaguni Islands and the Yunaguni Temple. He's been there. I think Graham has dived there too. And we're going to hear from Dr. Greg Little and his wife, Laura, in about a month on the dives they've made in Mexico and in the Bimini area off of the coast of Florida and what they have discovered. Now, in that case, they were following the information provided by Edgar Cayce, the great seer, who wrote a great deal. In fact, he wrote volumes of information on Atlantis. And we're going to have Greg on with his wife, Laura, in about a month. And this is brand new. And I think you're going to find it pretty startling what they discovered, which is direct evidence of underwater dwellings. Now, today we're going to hear from Daryl Miklos. And just to shortly recap, they were looking for evidence of shipwrecks, and they were using a map by the astronaut Gordon Cooper, who, while orbiting the Earth back in the late 60s and early 70s in the Mercury program, he was charting evidence of Soviet bases in the Caribbean, Cuba, and in other oceanic parts. And as he was doing that, he also was tracking shipwrecks. He had an interest in that personally. And this anomaly he found using onboard equipment. So, and what Daryl Miklos found was under about 300 feet of water was the evidence of ruined cities and this big anomaly that the news media thought was a UFO. Now, one of the things I thought was interesting, and by the way, we had Daryl Miklos on the program about, 2019, August 2019. And at that time, he had mentioned that under 300 feet of water, the estimated age of the ruins by the archaeological team that was with him was around 20,000 years ago. So the water that rose to 300 feet would account for that date. So that is pretty amazing right there. So, but there's been a lot of other discoveries. One of the most famous is the Roman shipwreck in the Mediterranean. And in 1901, they found a device which the research team later called the Antikytheria mechanism. And this is one of the earliest computers that has been discovered. And they don't know the history of it because they've never found anything else on it. They've never found any writing. It looks like really an out-of-place artifact on many, many levels, because the Greeks did not have any type of history of making mechanical devices like that. And it's either handed down, or more precisely, it was given just to a handful of people who had access to this technology over 2,000 years ago. The Antikytherian mechanism is really an anomalous device, and it leads people like Graham Hancock into thinking that perhaps there was a branch of an earlier civilization that was still around 2,000 years ago that were making these clockwork mechanisms that were run by gears. Now, this is one of the great mysteries of the ancient world, is this mechanism, this device that was used to follow the celestial bodies of different planets. It was made for navigation. And, you know, all the hints that we have about it in Atlantis were that they were a maritime culture that navigated the circumference of our planet Earth and had satellites everywhere. I see evidence of unknown civilization building in the Yucatan of Mexico. And there's a lot of anomalous structures that are not really named or known about that are throughout Mexico and Central America. And you see other anomalous structures in different parts of Europe and the Mediterranean. So we don't know if 2,000 years ago there were still traces of Atlanteans, or they had morphed into other cultures and they had the technology which led to the Antikytheria mechanism. So it's a real big question. So I've wanted to have more underwater, more archaeologists who do dives come out to the program and speak to us. So today, Daryl Miklos returns for a short recap and update on what's going on with this, with the anomalies that he found in the Caribbean Sea. And then in about a month, we're going to talk to a team, a husband and wife team, the Littles, who actually found evidence of ruined buildings in the Caribbean, in Mexico, and in other parts of Central and South America that correspond to what Edgar Cayce writes about in his book. So this is interesting because you got two different types of data. You have Gordon Cooper's maps, which are created from orbits around the Earth. And then you have a great seer or a present-day psychic presenting data transmitted from the ethos or the what has been known forever as the Akashic Records. This is like it's a database of knowledge in the past, in the present, and in the future. He was given data on a person, where they are located, some basic featured information about that person. He would tap into them and then could talk about and bring up their past lives. And a great deal of the readings, as they call them, which is what he gave people, were readings, had to do with lifetimes in Atlantis. And the data became so specific that Greg and his wife Laura were able to trace exactly some of the areas he was talking about, and they struck gold in a number of places. And we'll hear from Greg and Laura, which I'm happy to say is going to join him in a program in about a month. This is a unique approach that you would not hear on National Geographic because they just wouldn't follow that, you know. It just wouldn't be presented. So So this is what we're looking into: underwater archaeology, the search for Atlantis. And it gives you a different perspective on just what has come to pass thousands and thousands of years ago. So underwater archaeology is the program. And I hope you enjoy it. So it's been a while since we checked in with my friend Clifford Mahudi. Remember, he is the Zuni elder from the Kachina clan, and he has been a regular presenter in a number of conferences. We were just speaking before we started about the fact that this pandemic has really hampered the conferences in the United States and around the world. So he has not been able to really get out much, but I wanted to touch base with him regarding what I had heard was a prophecy of this pandemic, of this global epidemic. And Cliff, how you doing, man? It's been a while. How are things going?
I'm doing excellent under the conditions. I'm doing great.
Fantastic. All right. Well, what do you attribute this pandemic as you see it from a native prophecy or known events that were foretold?
Well, I think what would happen is that you'll eventually get away, because if you look at other disasters, this is like a disaster a natural disaster. If you look at a flood, earthquake, a tsunami, or a big fire, a hurricane. We're in hurricane season on the East Coast right now.
Yeah.
And if you recall when a human being, and I saw this in San Francisco during the earthquake in 1989, I was there right downtown. So when these things happen, people come together. Mm-hmm. And they let everybody becomes, they start talking with each other. No more is there any racial boundaries. You're not going to say, well, you're white or you're polka dot or you're orange or green or whatever. And then all different classes, whether you're a middle class, a rich person or you're a poor guy, they all work together for a common cause. Mm-hmm. And this also further deviated that approach by the United States government coming up with a multi-$1 trillion, well, I think so far it's about $6 trillion, which doesn't solve a damn thing.
Yeah.
If you look at it right now, only less than 10% will go to the COVID, and it shut down everything. And you can blame any political party or any other group, but you know, the man did it to themselves.
Okay.
And they're trying to make an excuse of saying that, well, it's because of this certain virus that this bat. If that was the case, they would have defeated it right away. Because, again,
yeah,
I'm basing this back on my scientific training. And I was quite involved with a lot of toxic substances because I was the director of that program.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a doctor. I am not an MD, but I am an environmental guy that had to deal with it on the physical level.
Wow.
So,
okay, interesting. So that's you're saying that in your vision of it, this pandemic is actually going to help people come together and align to defeat this virus.
No. I said that if they did not interfere, if the government did not interfere with that, you had to go through the whole course, like my analogy of the alcoholic. An alcoholic will only recover when it crashes and burns, and this one didn't, because when it was ready to crash and burn, the United States government, through their political organization, doesn't make any difference what party or what, whatever. It was just another way to start spending money, and that's going to have a long-term effect. It's going to affect the grandchildren of those people that are here right now, maybe great-grandchildren, as far as money is concerned. And they opened the gates up for the next economic collapse. And it was planned. It was planned by these people. I do not exactly know who they are, but I'm working on those from many different sources of who actually planned this. Because in the American Indian system, there is always a group that plans those things. Mm-hmm. That's why the grandfathers of past, when you talk about the Hopi grandfathers and some of our people, that's why they never let out about letting the public know, because they would be accused of being heretics or you know, theorists or whatever. That's why they never talk about it in open ways.
Okay.
And I'm the one that talks about these things, because actually it's I'm already out there anyway. So.
All right. Well, Clifford, thank you for that insight. I was curious to hear from you, and I hadn't talked to you for a while. So thanks for giving us a quick overview of the Native look at this this global pandemic. So thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
All right, we're heading to England and speaking with our science editor, Bruce Fenton. And Bruce is going to present some information in an article regarding an update on the Antikythera mechanism, which is the oldest computer ever found. It's estimated to be 2,000 years old. Hey, Bruce, how you doing?
Hi, Cliff. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well, thanks. Yep.
Cool.
Weather's picking up, getting warmer.
Excellent. Hey, so what's the latest on this? Did they find a key component that they part of this computer, or what? What's the story?
Well, they think that they've managed to now finally kind of create a virtual model of how the various parts fit together. And so it gives them a kind of an understanding of how this was actually created, you know, the kind of level of technology you need to do it, what components we don't see, because obviously so much of it is compressed, right? Compressed into a block, you know, parts were missing. So right. they've had to do a kind of extrapolation from what we do have as to, you know, how could the ancient Greeks have actually made this work? You know, how could they have got this kind of the accuracy? And obviously for people that don't really understand, they know that this is essentially a way of tracking the movement of the heavens. You know, you had pointers, almost like a clock face, with arms pointing for different planets and, you know,
right.
I think stars as well, obviously the moon. And so it was just considered as being so ahead of its time, you know, for 2,000 years ago, that there was a missing kind of technological development to it, that we have no real understanding of the inner mechanisms beyond the fact that it run on cogs and gears. You know, there's elements that just we couldn't see from the remnants we had. So this team is from University College London have basically kind of come up with a theoretical model of the missing components that they want to actually now go forward and create a model.
Yeah. For those of you not familiar with the Antikythera mechanism, it was found in an area of water, deep underwater. I believe it was in a Roman shipwreck. They found it in 1901, and it is a computer for all intents and purposes. It's a computer. And they think, and I read this a while ago, that this mechanism was one of perhaps thousands that were created for maritime purposes to tell where you're located. And what else was it good for, Bruce?
Yeah, because also it was used to calculate events, like when they would have the Olympics and obviously sort of celebratory events. Because back then, a lot of these these events were calculated based on astrology. So, right. You know, they needed to know where a certain planet would be or when a certain eclipse would be to be able to plan future events. So it had a lot of use in that kind of area as well. Obviously, that was to do with the way the Greek culture itself functioned. I mean, although it's accurate to how the Greeks viewed the solar system, and we have to keep in mind as well that they believed that they were at the center of the solar system, you know, that all of the planets were going around the Earth.
Right.
So although it's accurate to what they felt, you know, we wouldn't consider it accurate today. But I mean, that's more of a factor of just that they didn't have that missing bit of knowledge, you know, that of course that we were all going around the sun. It doesn't really take away from how extraordinary the mechanisms itself were. You know, just obviously they didn't have that little bit of key knowledge about the solar system. But the thing is that, yeah, really is that it's just, you know, there's no developmental track. Because you think about it, you think, well, normally you'd expect to find, right, other mechanisms that are kind of similar. And as you yeah. say, they expect there must be more of these. We don't find those, but we also don't see any precursors. You know, there's nothing else with the cogs and gears like this that's known from ancient Greece or even any of the cultures, you know, that they were trading with or associated with. So it really kind of appears in the historical record out of nowhere. And that's always been one of the big conundrums is, you know, how could someone have just come up with all these cogs and gears and this kind of map of the solar system out of nowhere? So yeah. It's been sort of a double mystery, you know, how was it done and where's the development stages for it?
It really is the ultimate out of place artifact simply because it has no history. We don't find it anywhere else in the world. And if they are suggesting this was a routine device carried by mariners, that means it has some kind of developmental history that we just don't know about. It's lost in time because we just don't have any tracks. All right, I'm going to post this on the Facebook page. You're going to see it under Bruce Fenton, this week's banner, Underwater Archaeology with Daryl Miklos. And take a look at the parts that they found and what they estimated originally looked like. I think you'll be fascinated by this device that is perhaps over 2,000 years in the past. All right, this is great, Bruce. Any last thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, there's still, just to say, there is one problem with the model they've kind of come up with, and that is that it requires some very precise inner concentric tubes within the mechanism, mm-hmm. and they really are dubious to whether or not the Greeks had the technology to kind of machine these out and actually use them. So it's going to be a bit, wait and see whether or not what they come up with could have really been done by the ancient Greeks, you know, because we have to see what model they come up with.
Okay, so is that a suggestion that maybe the Greeks inherited from an earlier culture?
Well, yeah, if the Greeks could do what these scientists think is required, yeah, it would question the level of technology they had, you know, if we'd had machine engineering that they're not supposed to have. So
that's fascinating.
That's one of the issues the scientists have come up with. They said that if their model is right, it does question the technological level.
Yeah, cool. All right, Bruce, this is a good one. I appreciate it. You take care. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Remember back in late 2018, I had a guest on the program named Daryl Miklos, and Daryl was the host and star of a Discovery Channel program known as Cooper's Treasure. And for those of you who don't remember who Daryl Miklos was, he is the co-founder of Gemini Marine Exploration, a company that specializes in historical shipwreck recovery. And he was befriended by Gordon Cooper and was able to get his hands on Gordon's maps. But I have Daryl back with me. We wanted to get an update and check in with him. We haven't talked to him in a while. And this pandemic has wreaked havoc on a lot of businesses. And I wanted to get, like I mentioned, an update. So, hey, Daryl, how are you? How you doing?
I'm doing good, Cliff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're in Florida right now, right?
I am.
Okay, you're down there. All right, so I want to kind of do a review of what has transpired and then cut to the chase and get into what you are currently doing and hoping to do in the coming months and years. So Cooper's Treasures was based on your relationship with Gordon Cooper. And Cooper flew the Mercury and Gemini missions in the 60s, correct?
That's true.
Okay. So this is one thing that I didn't get clarity on. His capsule had a lot of advanced technology on it, didn't it?
It did. So when you saw the show on season one, I sat down with a bunch of engineers who put together the spacecraft that they built for Mercury and Gemini. Now, referring back to Mercury, these were the Mercury 9 engineers. And on the show, they were never able to actually verify what type of technology was implemented or used on the spacecraft. They don't like to call it space capsule for whatever reason. So I'm going to refer back to them and give them the respect that they want. They like to call it a spacecraft.
Okay.
That's why I don't say space capsule. But the spacecraft that they built for the Mercury mission, they were not able to tell me exactly what was on there, and because they'd all signed NDAs.
Oh, no, that's interesting.
I did have a private conversation with a couple of them, and they did verify that there was something on board the spacecraft that they used, albeit a crude version of a magnetometer. It wasn't really that successful, but the Russians had come out with a crude version of a magnetometer, I think even much earlier, back in 59, and were experimenting with that. And so NASA, you know, it was a space race. They all had to try and utilize that technology. So they didn't have much success. Most of the success with Gordon's flight when locating shipwreck locations was the fact that he was in Cape Canaveral training to be an astronaut on his weekends or days off. He bit people in the local Florida coastline, one being Kip Wagner, and he would made friends with them and dove on shipwrecks right off Cape Canaveral, pad 39, directly off the Cape. He actually located shipwrecks and worked with Kip on several other expeditions. And he was a very successful treasure hunter way before he ever made or set foot in space. And that's how he acquired the drive to look for shipwreck locations from his one and only bird's eye view. And the success of that was from taking photographs of the islands as his flight path crossed over the Caribbean. And with those photographs, he was a trade route of the Spanish, put together what we dubbed the treasure map from space by taking the photographs, picking the areas where the thoroughfares for the Spanish fleets at the time. And you're saying, using logic and common sense, there's going to be a shipwreck here, there's going to be one there. He didn't take pictures and go, oh my God, I see the mast of a ship. No, he said, that reef is right in the middle of that. It's going to be a shipwreck. They went and investigated it. He numbered the located shipwreck material, confirmed locations, had a chance to work on. And he was very successful in locating shipwreck material. And that's what the basis of the show was. I had the files before Gordon passed. He gave me the files that were numbered, but I had no idea what the numbers meant or where they corresponded because they were more detailed. They said, in this area, number one, I'll give you an example. Area number one, we have located this shipwreck. We believe it to be Spanish origin, English origin, whatever. We found these artifacts there to prove that there is shipwreck material there. But I didn't know where area number one, that's why I had to get it from my dad. My dad had the chart, he gave it to me, and putting those two pieces of the puzzle together, because you can't find treasure with just the chart or treasure map from space, and you can't find all the treasure with just the files. You needed both to do that, and that's the basis of the show.
So Gordon knew your dad, obviously, right?
He did. He met him in 1978 on the Merv Griffin Show. There was a show about adventures. One guy went around the world in a balloon, a hot air balloon. There was another man, I forgot, who sailed around the world. Then there was Gordon, who went around the world in a spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And then there was my dad, who went around the world looking for treasure. And those four people were on the show.
Now, did Gordon share his maps, release them to your dad to use, or did they go together to do, find these?
They were shipping partners. They were business partners. So they set up an expert.
Oh, okay.
They were working on this together. In fact, in 1997, I met Gordon as an adult. So I'm a child on the Merv Griffin Show, and he'd stop by the house a couple times. I'd say hello, but I was just a kid. I was more interested in surfing than I was taken aback by having an astronaut in my house, but my dad didn't want me around. So he kicked me out, made me go tell me to get lost. So I'd go surfing. It wasn't until I was in my early 30s that I met Gordon in the Bahamas, and they were trying to arrange for a license to salvage in the Bahamas. But we were there for 3 weeks. We pleaded with the government, but there was a recent moratorium just a few years before that was put in place that was almost impossible to have them lift. And so we failed at getting a license, but that's when I first saw the treasure map from space, yet seen the files. And my dad bought the treasure map from Gordon for $8,000. I do remember that. Yeah, in cash. He gave it to my dad. Said, look, if you're not going to use it, I'll buy it from you. So he paid him $8,000 for the treasure map. And even though they were business partners, my dad offered to pay him that money. He took the money and my dad kept the chart. And then I was telling Gordon, well, I got to go back to California and I'm trying to start a boat company in the meantime until we get the expedition going. Do you have any idea where I can rent office space? And he goes, well, I've got office. I mean, there's a whole room next to me I'm not using. If you want, you can share it with me. And that's how I became really close to Gordon.
Yeah, I want to, and that's a great segue into my next series of questions. You had a close relationship with him. One of the things that I wanted to drill into a little bit is that even though he was in these Mercury and Gemini space programs, these space missions, which appear to be races against the Russians for dominance in space, one of the true reasons for being in this capsule was to observe and track military installations. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So especially in 1963 on the Mercury mission, the reason they were even experimenting with the magnetometer and they were hoping to locate nuclear missile silos that might be potentially aimed at, funded by Cuba and Russia, you know, that whole Cold War purpose of the DOD being so tightly apt into the space program. So believe it or not, the space program was designed for military use from the get-go. And it was to benefit the military and to get a foothold on space, and especially the tight war that they were going through with Russia. And now Russia was doing the same thing. So yeah, he was able to locate a few, from my understanding. In fact, I know where one was, and that has been since been removed. So he had some success in locating, but while he was up there, he goes, you know, everybody else is, I'm just going to take photographs. And then in the meantime, he was taking photographs, not only for location of these potential nuclear sites or warheads, whatever you want to call them, nuclear threats or towards the aimed at the U.S., he was taking pictures for the government. He was allowed to review the photography that he had taken, and he made this treasure map from space as well. So he was killing two birds with one stone at no cost for to the space program.
And as far as you know, and of course, maybe he couldn't tell you this, and these engineers obviously had signed NDAs, the electronic equipment on board was used to sense these nuclear warheads and installations. But what Gordon did is spend a little extra time and use that to focus down and to pin where these shipwrecks were, right?
Well, imagine you've got bird's eye view, it's crystal clear skies, and you can see the bottom of the ocean because all that part of the Caribbean. was really clear, shallow water. It wasn't hard to see reefs and to be able to identify them visually. But how can you possibly remember them all that you've seen unless you were to take photographs? So he took photographs of all those areas. Plus, he had to take photographs of those islands because I know of one missile silo that was located on an island that was very, very light population, but it was a full nuclear missile silo aimed at the U.S.
Wow.
Actually, I can't say any more about it, but that's all I can tell you that I saw with my own eyes one. And it's no longer there, by the way. But that was his job. And while he was there, he's going, my God, I can see everything. And he goes, oh, my God, that's the Columbus Passage. Oh, my God, this is the route they took from Mexico yeah. City or Veracruz to Havana. And then from Havana to following the Florida Straits all the way to Spain. So he knew this. And it was simple. It was easy for him to put together this sea chart.
So was he using a spacecraft installed camera, or was he taking photos from a handheld camera?
It was a handheld camera.
Oh my handheld God. Camera. And he could get the lens was such a length that he could really focus in and zoom into areas, I guess.
Yeah. I went to the Eastman Mansion in Rochester, New York, and I met with the people who were directly involved with the museum, because now a museum, and they were telling me about how advanced the cameras were back then and the clarity. Oh my God. If you saw the clarity of some of the film on those photos mm-hmm. of the negatives, you couldn't believe that a film camera could take that good of pictures. The detail, because you could zoom it. I'll give you an example. I had one of the photographs in front of me. I took a picture of it with my cell phone. And then I zoomed in, you know, touch screen, zoomed in to get a detail on the photograph. The film was so good. I could see every little detail through my cell phone by zooming in on the photograph. And I went, oh, my God, that must have been some incredible film that they were using. And they built special cameras for the astronauts to take pictures. Maybe today's technology way surpassed those cameras, but you got to remember, this is 1963.
Yeah.
And that's pretty dang good technology. And Gordon also had 20/10 vision, and with the refraction of the light, and there's some sort of magnification being in space, that also aided in being able to visually identify areas, and the camera would zoom in and utilize that magnification and get crystal clear photographs.
He was a jet pilot.
Incredible.
Yeah, he had to have good vision because he was a jet pilot, right?
So. Yeah, he was a test pilot, so he was a badass. And that's why he was the main character in the original movie called The Right Stuff. I believe there's a new one coming out from Disney, if it's not out already. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'd like to see it, but I do know that he told me that one time all the astronauts were there. It was probably about 100 of them. And they watched a Titan rocket go up and blow up right there on the pad. And the director of whoever was training the astronauts was saying, so how many of you still want to be astronauts? And Gordon raised his hand and he said, not all of them did.
Yeah, I could imagine it'd be kind of scary.
And so they just slowly weeded through the biggest badasses in town. Like, there was no fear. Gordon had no fear. He had so much. He either lacked in brains and made it up in lack of fear. I just don't know. But he was so smart. He just believed in technology. And that goes back to what we were earlier talking about. The belief in technology and knowing the risks and being able to make a cognizant choice as to whether you want to make that risk. And that's all I ask of science.
Okay. Let's jump forward to the discovery of this underwater anomaly. Obviously, you were following Gordon's map and you dove with your team, or members of your team dove. And where was this? Well, you can't give us specifics, obviously, but this is the Caribbean Ocean find, right?
Right. It was in the Caribbean. It was in the Bermuda Triangle. I will tell you that much. We dove on a wreck site. It was a wreck site location that was really hard to determine what it was that Gordon was pointing out there. Mm-hmm. I think there was an arrow and said possible wreck site, or I forgot. I don't have it here, the chart with me, but we went and investigated. We're actually trying the submersible. It's a two-man submersible. We went down 300 feet just to try the equipment out and test run this on a really calm day. And when we went down there, we discovered what we believed to be remnants of an ancient civilization. And when I say that, that's still it still qualifies as an underwater submerged object, USO. But it was taken out of context and made it to look like that we were claiming that we saw something of alien origins.
Yeah, I want to get into that in a second, but I think I'm curious about, first of all, did you feature this discovery on the TV show?
It was, there was a quick excerpt between commercials that said, it goes, oh my God, I'm sitting in the capsule going, oh my God, I can't believe what I saw. I've never seen anything like that before. It's only because when we went down there, I thought I was looking at a mast of a ship, but if it was wooden, it wouldn't been eaten away by the conditions of the ocean because it's organic material. If it was metal, it would have been rusted. It just didn't make any sense. I thought it was a large mast, and it just ended up being a large linear object sticking out of a seawall. And there were multiple examples of that. And then up on the, that was on the side of the seawall, up on the plateau at the top of the seawall, we located what we believe to be foundations to structures. And if that were the case, then I mean, it would look like a small city or a very large town, because it had pathways going through it. There were objects that appeared to be staircase formation of these foundation looking like structures. Because when one thing you know about Mother Nature, after having dove so many dives in the water, and I've done thousands in my lifetime, is that Mother Nature doesn't build right angles. Very rarely, not to say never, but very rarely do you see them. And very rarely would you see them in groups of hundreds in one location. And that was the case here.
Now, you talk about this submergible, this two-man mini submarine. Where was what was the level of depth? Was it more than a couple hundred feet? What was the depth?
We went down to about 350 feet. And as we came up, we noticed something at about 300 feet, 290 feet depth.
Wow. And so 300 feet, that's pretty deep.
Yeah. And so if that's the case, let's just take it back. A lot of people are going, oh, well, if it's not an alien spaceship, which we are definitely saying that we are not verifying that in any way, shape, or form. It's been taken out of context on multiple occasions. But we also can't explain what it is that we're seeing. But we believe it to be man-made structures. If that's the case, given the depth and the rise of the oceans, it would take that period of time back to 16 to 20,000 years ago. It would be a really ancient civilization. So then the first thing that comes to the public's mind is that the ancient city of Atlantis. Well, if that's the case, I don't know. There's no proof that Atlantis even existed.
Right.
Or if it's even called Atlantis. Yeah. There's no signposts that are still up saying, welcome to the city of Atlantis. What happens in Atlantis stays in Atlantis. There's no signposts. So it takes so much investigative work to ever verify, even if it's man-made. It may just be some rare anomalous regions of right angles, which would be ridiculous to believe in my eyes, made by Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Especially given all the other stuff that we saw, which appeared to be fallen columns, and then there was perfectly circular rings everywhere. It was just bizarre.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, Daryl, I remember talking to you when you were up here at a conference a couple of years ago, and in the talk you said that there were 15, what was it?
Linear projectile.
Yeah, no, wait, it had 15, 30, 300-foot long-arm projectiles jutting out from the center of the object. What the heck was that?
Well, look, I don't know if I don't know if those are my exact words, but I will tell you 300 feet is not something I said. I said at least 30 feet, 30 meters, maybe.
Oh, okay.
So I think it was taken out of context to say 300 feet. I did not say that. I believe that on the average, they were about 50 to 60 feet long. But irregardless, let's just take an object that is a linear projectile coming out of a wall, a seawall.
Right.
So it's sticking horizontally out of a vertical seawall in an area where the current runs 3 to 4 knots constantly. If this were a natural growth formation, i.e. coral or some sort of limestone formation, it would have been beaten back by the currents and been pressed against the seawall. Eventually, as it grew out further, it would be pushed back, kind of like a tree that's on in an area of wind that's constantly blowing. That tree is going to grow crooked in the direction that the wind is blowing.
Right.
And that would have been the case here. So we believe this to be some sort of structure underneath the coral growth. And we believe that that may be remnants of some sort of man-made structure. That's what we believe.
Yeah. I mean, didn't you have a couple of scientists on the team that were looking at this either through a remote camera or up close? I mean, you had some professional divers with you, didn't you?
Yeah. The gentleman, Robert Carmichael, who ran the submersible for us, had a group of people out in that area years before, just a couple of years before, who said, "Oh my God, just see what else is up here." And he was just going through this. He goes, we went down with divers and we could not figure it out. He goes, and this is an example. When we went down testing the sub, we just found one example. He had found multiple examples of this previously. And it's just amazing what they were able to get video footage of, and just incredible. But things have changed a lot since even then, and the technology is advancing and special. In some ways, doing this later is better for us because technology is advancing daily. And I don't know, you know, it's bugging the heck out of me not being able to be out there all the time and going to those steps. But given COVID and a bunch of other things that came in the way, the thing that I'm currently working on are treasure wrecks that are in shallow water that are easier for me and things that I'm more accustomed to working on. And, why we haven't made much headway on the project.
I want to get into, I want to update people on exactly where you're at. But before we do that, you've had 2 years since your discovery of this. Your submersible driver apparently, and this is what I did. You never told me this, Daryl, that he had been there before or a place close to it. So this could actually be a small city or for lack of a better word, an office building of some kind with multiple foundations and pathways. What have you come to a conclusion on? I mean, I think the UFO thing, or as you call it, unidentified submerged object, is kind of stretching it a bit. But what have you come to in the time you've had since you've dove? What do you feel about it?
I want to take soil samples. I want to take samples of the linear projectiles, find out what they're made of. And we would love to be able to do that, bring that back to a lab and get it to a metallurgist if they're of metallic origin, test the the soil samples to find out if it's of natural origin or man-made, a mixture of man-made materials. We don't know. It's just that the fact is there's not enough to make a conclusion as to what it is until we actually undergo an investigation. So what I believe and what I know are two different things. Say, and we found an ancient civilization older than any other in this part of the world. And I would love to be able to say that. That's what I'm hoping I'll be able to. Again, we still have to go through with the investigation. In the meantime, I'm doing early colonial period investigations, expeditions that still feed this thing, that this urgency to be underwater and discover things that I have in my blood that I can't get up.
Right. So you've made
unless
a number
I get a full
of,
body trans blood transfusion.
you've made a number of dives following that discovery, obviously. And in 2020, were you able to dive, or has this been more recent dives in that area or for the Caribbean?
So I've been diving on and off throughout 2020 looking for shipwreck material, and I've been very lucky to have been able to do that. I haven't been able to make a full season out of it like normal because of COVID. But however, it looks like things are loosening up, and it looks like we may be able to get out in the water more frequently. And if that's the case, then that's when we're going to go full bore on this investigation of that anomalous area 300 feet below.
Right. So obviously, and in most cases, when you want to do a serious dive, it's extremely expensive. You know, I think you said $1 million or close to it. What kind of a team are you going to assemble to do the next dive in the anomalous area?
Well, I'm going to stick with my buddy who runs the submersibles. He knows a bunch of divers that are much better divers than myself. I tend to dive in shallow water. I don't use nitric oxide or all these special gases, the mixed gases that they use to be able to stay at depths of 300 feet for more than an hour at a time, in some cases 2 hours long. To me, I'm not at the age, nor am I well trained enough, and I don't know that I want to train myself to be the kind of diver that does that just yet, because I still have young children and I want to survive enough to be able to tell the story. So I'll stick to the submarine, and then I'll have the younger, more well-trained divers and stuff, and we can start doing samples if we get a mechanical arm to come off of the submarine, take soil samples that way, lift anything that we do. If any material that we're bringing up, we can bring it up through the submarine. But I would love to work with a bunch of scientists and marine biologists that know or and are familiar with the local fauna and the local biology in that area, in that region, and see if it coincides with Mother Nature or if there's something different. And that's all we can do. It's a scientific effort.
Yeah. Which is great. Didn't you say that you budgeted for an underwater archaeologist on this last when you were there to find this anomaly, or was that going to happen later? That was your, I forget.
Yeah, the underwater archaeologist is the easy part about it. It's just the cost associated in weather systems associated with actually undertaking an investigation like this. You have diver safety is primary,
right?
And in this is open water. So this is not landmarks. This is not the leeward side of an island where we're catching flat water. This is nowhere near land. This is a 300-foot dive to a certain plateau in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle that, you know, it's very difficult to get the right weather conditions. And then if you miss it and you don't get the weather window right, you've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then you've got to get everybody's timetables, who can work when and how, and it's not an easy thing to put together. And granted, I think had COVID not appeared, I think we would already be done with this and be talking about our findings.
I find it fascinating that the photos that were taken of this anomalous structure in the area are fairly clear. And if that's 300 feet underwater, that's pretty clear water, isn't it?
Oh, I think the visibility in some cases is probably close to 400 feet, wow, given the right time of the year. You got light refracts really well underwater, and it's amazing the clarity of the water there already. And the way the light refracts, you can see forever. I mean, it's just fabulous. I have not the words that's, you know, I'm not necessarily, I don't know who created this world, but whoever made that part was masterful. Fantastic. Because it's just gorgeous.
All right, so let's get the final question to you, final couple of questions. When are you anticipating getting back to that area?
Well, we're hoping that we can get to it, at least get the initial part done. What we want to do is initially get an ROV, a remotely operated vehicle or vessel, and shoot it down to that region and get some real 4K definition video feed of the area. That's the least expensive and least dangerous way to start this Okay. And we're hoping to do that by summer, if not the end of summer at the latest. And that's what we're going to work on. But again, it's all in Mother Nature's hands and weather and all of that. We want to be able to do this privately so that we're not being, we have to be very careful about when we're doing and where we are and who may be around it. You know, so it's a very secret area that we are able to publicly come out with our finding.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you said that the pilot of the submergible was familiar with that area. Why hasn't he published or discussed what he found? Sounds like prior to your dive.
It's because both of us, in the same way that I am, we're very secretive about what our discoveries are. And then since then, putting together these types of projects is difficult. And I don't think he had any conclusive evidence that he was willing. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear
okay.
Me?
Okay. Your picture changed. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry.
I didn't think he had any conclusive evidence enough to come publicly about it. I know that he would have loved to have done that. There's been a few things written about it through, maybe not, I don't know. He's just being secretive. We're all very secretive.
Yeah, you have to be. You have to be.
We're just trying to keep this tight lit. That's why.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm talking about it on this podcast.
Well, I just wrote you a check for $100,000. That's why you're talking.
Oh, really? Wow. Maybe you could help us fund this dive if you're that generous.
I want to be on the boat for that kind of money.
Make sure you let people know I'm not being paid for this.
I know. No, but I support your work. And heck, I mean, look, if you actually turn up what you suspect is there, I think the sky's the limit in terms of not only promotion, you know, this is one of those National Geo or Smithsonian specials that, or History Channel or Discovery Channel specials that extend your brand, you know.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many networks, if you were to approach them with an idea like this, because then the first thing they're thinking, well, could this be the lost city of Atlantis? Okay, let's just say they use that as the hook.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised how many networks would think, well, we're not really interested in it unless maybe after you're done, because the fact is there's been so many shows about the lost city of Atlantis and or yeah. undiscovered cities that it's not as exciting to them. Until actually a discovery has been made and proven to be whatever the findings results say they are. And that's usually the case. It's kind of like putting the cart before the horse. That's the way they see it. So it's hard to get even people excited about this from a network's point of view to, you know, what if, because in their mind is, well, what if you're wrong?
I mean, but the funny thing about it, Daryl, is that you already have this visual evidence, which is pretty telling. Even without cutting into it or getting samples to analyze, I think you have some fairly interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Then there's the other side of the coin where we'd like to be able to do this in private and then choose our this and, you know, get the best bang for our buck, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, it's kind of hard. I mean, I don't know. I don't. We want to be able to keep the wheels turning, and it takes money, and so it's unfortunate that we're not all just floating in billions of dollars. I wish my last name was Bezos.
Hey, well, wait a minute. Wouldn't Discovery Fund part of a dive?
Well, I don't know. I've never really. See, the thing about networks is they want to know that there's proof that this is actually there and that this is not just another show that's going to end up
on the cutting floor. Yeah.
Looking for something. And then at the end, nothing ever really happens.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of speculation as to discoveries being made that people think are the lost city of Atlantis. And there's no definitive proof. I think that because the audience is wants to know that you are going to find something, you're going to prove that you found something, and it's no longer just a guessing game. At the end, they're all going to be satisfied that you found what you were looking for. And that one thing is what the networks are looking for, because they want to be able to please their audience.
Yeah.
And not everybody's willing to take that risk.
Well, maybe it's better that you don't use a major network or a cable channel, because they may have requirements for the money that
if somebody has an open mind that works for a network that would be willing to cover something like this, I'd be willing to talk to them. But other than that, we're just going to have to do it ourselves. And after the fact, if our findings are correct, they'll probably go, dang, I missed that boat. Literally.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for getting us an update. If you're going to be diving in the summertime with a remote vehicle, underwater vehicle, that should provide some pretty good details of at least a number of the areas. If you could get on top of the foundations of that city and get some details of the column work, or man, if you found a staircase, you got gold. If you think about it, finding something that we see every day 300 feet underwater, that's going to spark a hell of a lot of attention.
Yeah. And again, I want to say what we believe and what we can prove are two different things. So that is, again, what we believe. We think we found something that looks like a staircase. We believe what we found down there and what my buddy told me that he saw down there are foundations to buildings. We believe that the linear projectiles are of a man-made structure that is now covered by coral. We believe that these perfectly circular rings are part of something that made, and we believe a lot of things, but until we're done, I want to leave it as a what we believe. And until we get the scientific proof, I don't want to say that it is definitely a staircase or foundations or this. It's just what we believe. And we're very positive in what we believe, and we're willing to take a risk, and that's what we're going to do.
All right. My guest has been Daryl Miklos from Gemini Marine Exploration. I hope I can dial you up later in the summertime, maybe early fall, and say, hey, how'd it go? You might even jump it and go, man, I found gold.
Yeah. I wouldn't mind finding a shipwreck that landed right on top of it.
Well, I'm using that as an analogy rather than gold in the form of an artificial structure 300 feet underwater. Those of us who are seeking evidence of an ancient civilization under the water would just be amazed, and I think the world would stand on its ear to see and want to know more about it. So
yeah, me too.
Continued success, and we'll check in with you later.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you, Cliff, and thank you everybody for listening, and stay tuned.
I had a conversation just before we started with Daryl, and he has promised me a follow-up interview this fall after he dives with this remote viewing robot. The robot actually is going to have arms on it too, so they may be able to do some other scientific study on this anomalous feature. It really looks to me like some form of an observatory. But I mean, I'm even fascinated in the research that's going to be done on these buildings, if they are actual buildings or some kind of structure of some kind. I would really look forward to getting that information too. Whatever he finds, we'll hear about it and get a better understanding as to what is actually there. And in a month, in April, Greg Little and his wife will really show us what has already been discovered. And this has been revealed to a few people about 20 years ago. He has not made or published a great deal of information on what he has uncovered using Edgar Cayce's book data from readings on individuals who apparently lived in Atlantis thousands of years ago, perhaps tens of thousands of years ago, which is exciting. So stay tuned for that. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ancients, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you support the work we are doing each week on the program. And we have some surprise announcements coming up in the next couple of months. When I get back from Egypt in May, we are going to launch something new midweek, and we'll get more details on that as we we'll make an announcement, and you'll hear all about it. But we have a great archive of interviews and data that we haven't had a chance to publish. Plus, there is numerous episodes from when we first launched Earth Ancients back in 2014 that have little bits and pieces of snippets that we can create into a series. And we're going to do that. So you can get a sense of how Earth Ancients was launched and what we're all about. So to become a subscriber, go to Patreon, patreon.com/Earth Ancients and become a subscriber for $5 a month. You support the work we do here on the program. We have a whole bunch of real nice gifts for you as well. We have free eBooks from lots of authors. We have unpublished interviews, and you can access me almost directly. Send me an email going, "Hey man, what's going on here?" and I'll get back to you pretty quick. So please consider becoming a subscriber. patreon.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, I want to remind you that we have our Sacred Pyramid Tour in Mexico coming up October 7th through the 17th. It's half off, 50% off. It's a COVID special. It's normally about $5,000 for 10 days of all-inclusive travel, visits, and museum access. We are trimming it down to a couple grand, and all you got to do is get yourself over to Mexico City, which is our base, and you will join us. So please join us. We're only going to take 25 people. To get more information and see the entire itinerary, go to earthancients.com/tours, T-O-U-R-S, and come out and join us. We're only, like I said, going to take a small group. And we are going to see a ton of amazing artifacts, pyramids, and culture. We're going to see both Diego Rivera and his wife, Frida Calhoun. We're going to see both of their museums. And we're going to see a lot of marketplaces, too. So this is a kind of a nice getaway. It's COVID relief. It really is, because we've been stuck home and not able to go anywhere. So come out and join me. October 7th through the 17th, and the data is at earthancients.com/tours. Hey, if you want to come to Egypt, we got a couple of spots too. So that's May the 18th through the 30th, and you can go to the same place, earthancients.com/tours. All right, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining me. I want to thank Daryl Miklos, our guest today, the elder Clifford Mahudi, and as always, our science editor, Bruce Fenton, and the production assistant, Ruth Thomas. Ruth, you rock. Thanks for all your help. All right, take care, be well, and we will see you next week.